Good morning. This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the October 8th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. It has been 2 weeks since Attorney General Eric Holder announced his resignation. The debates about his performance in office will no doubt continue long after he's gone. At the moment, Holder is being given good grades for actions he has taken in defending voters' rights that have been under attack by Republicans in a number of states. It's an open question whether they begin to balance his hard-nosed enforcement of President Obama's encroachment on our civil liberties and his failure to prosecute any Wall Street banker or insurance executive over their roles in the 2008 financial meltdown. But there's another case involving Holder that at the moment is wrapped in mystery. It is his use of the quote-unquote state secrets privilege to stop a defamation suit filed by a millionaire shipping owner in Greece against a private nonprofit organization based in New York, claiming that allowing the case to proceed in court will involve the release of highly classified information. With that information may pertain to the Justice Department will not explain. Without knowing all the details, however, it's not hard to make an educated guess. The sole function of the organization being sued, United Against Nuclear Iran, is to ensure that economic sanctions levied by Congress against Iran are enforced. Its modus operandi is to expose companies across the globe that continue to do business with Iran despite the sanctions and publicly demand that they cease and desist. In the instance that this has led to the present court case, a Victor Restis, a millionaire Greek ship owner, claims that United Against Nuclear Iran made false and malicious charges against him that would benefit a rival shipper who is a major financial backer of the UANI. The fact that a former head of Mossad, Meir Dagan, is on UANI's advisory board, as is veteran White House counselor Dennis Ross, once described by a fellow colleague in the State Department as quote-unquote Israel's lawyer, gives a hint that UANI is not just your run-of-the-mill nonprofit with a political agenda. To sort it all out, I'll be turning at 20 minutes past the hour to a frequent guest on Takes on the World, Grant Smith, director of the Institute for Research Middle East in Washington, who is a reigning expert on the chicanery that involves Israel and its U.S. lobby. So stay tuned for that. Since the suit was filed, UANI had refrained from demanding that foreign companies halt their dealings with Iran, but yesterday it couldn't restrain itself, issuing a press release condemning a Europe-Iran business forum that's scheduled to take place in London on October 15th and 16th. In its statement, United Against Nuclear Iran called, quote, on all firms reportedly participating in the first European-Iran forum, including Italian industrial conglomerate and U.S. defense contractor Finmeccanica, to fully disclose the nature and extent of any Iran business activities. UANI is also calling for clarification of the purpose of these firms' participation in the forum, if not to capitalize on, quote, commercial opportunities, end quote, in Iran. UANI previously applauded Finmeccanica for committing to no new Iran business at this time. The presence of European businesses at the Iran forum directly contravenes the efforts of the international community to maintain economic pressure on the Iranian regime, the UANI statement went on. It also indicates such companies, quote, apparent indifference to President Obama's pledge to come down like a ton of bricks on foreign firms expanding their Iran business, end quote. Finmeccanica technically became a U.S. defense contractor when it signed a $141 million contract with Lockheed Martin to produce wing assemblies for the Air Force's F-35 stealth jet fighter that's scheduled to be delivered in 2016. Italy, one of 9 U.S. allies participating in the project, has already invested $3.1 billion in getting the plane off the ground and into its Air Force fleet. In a letter to Finmeccanica CEO Mauro Moretti, UANI CEO Mark Wallace expressed his concern that the Europe-Iran Forum's stated goal that, quote, would provide participants with a unique opportunity to debate and network with over 200 senior business executives from across sectors, as well as policymakers from Iran and Europe, on the opportunities and challenges represented by Iran's valuable and largely untapped marketplace, end quote. The UANI does not like that. Ignacio Moncada, chairman of FATA, a Finmeccanica subsidiary, is scheduled to be one of the forum speakers. It is indirectly, in an indirectly related subject, Jewish Business News reported yesterday that Israel's Elbit Systems has been awarded the Elbit Systems U.S. subsidiary has been awarded the contract to deliver a technology demonstration for a mission-critical secure broadband service solution for first responders and public safety users by the American Department of Homeland Security. According to Jewish Business News, Israel, quote, has always been known to excel in both security and high tech, and its companies have also succeeded where the two fields meet. This is evidenced, it says, by the fact that Elbit and other Israeli firms have actually established successful subsidiaries in the U.S. and get government contracts, end quote. What the article does not mention is that security services at all the U.S. airports involved on 9/11, and the two in Europe, in Paris and Amsterdam, that were used by the shoe and underwear bombers, were provided by an Israeli security firm as well. Well, Vice President Joe Biden is known for his gaffes when speaking off script, but one in which he told the truth last week came quickly back to bite him. Vice President Biden has apologized after saying U.S. allies in the Middle East funded and armed extremist rebels in Syria. He made the comments in a speech at Harvard last week. Answering a question about the Islamic State following his speech, Biden replied, quote, "Our biggest problem is our allies. Our allies in the region were our largest problem in Syria. The Turks were great friends, and I have a great relationship with Erdogan, which I've just spent a lot of time with. The Saudis, the Emiratis, etc. What were they doing? They were so determined to take down Assad and essentially have a proxy Sunni-Shia war. What did they do? They poured hundreds of millions of dollars and tens of thousands and tons of weapons into anyone who would fight against Assad. Except the people who were being supplied were al-Nusra and al-Qaeda and the extremist elements of jihadis coming from other parts of the world," end quote. That was Joe Biden being honest at Harvard, but it's not, however, part of a vice president's job description. So over the weekend, Biden made personal call to Turkish President Erdogan and then to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed of the United Arab Emirates, apologizing for his spilling the beans. The White House says Biden expressed regret, quote, for any implication that U.S. allies and partners in the region had intentionally supplied or facilitated the growth of ISIS or other violent extremists in Syria, end quote. Intentionally is the key word. While everyone knows Biden was speaking the truth. On the same front, the Kagans are back. You remember the Kagans. That's Fred Kagan, brother PNAC founder Robert Kagan, and Fred's wife Kimberly, all fixtures in the neocon community. Fred, you may remember, was the architect of the surge, which at the time was credited with America's winning the war in Iraq. We did win it, didn't we? Well, in yesterday's LA Times, they are offering more advice. Under the headline, quote, U.S. strategy against Islamic State is too much air, not enough boots, they write, quote, air operations in Iraq and Syria have not stopped the advance of Islamic State. Despite the bombing, the al-Qaeda splinter group has launched a series of offensives in Iraq, gaining new ground in Anbar province, and has continued its offensive in Syria. The desultory bombing mission, far too limited to merit being called an air campaign, has no chance of enabling local allies to eliminate Islamic State sanctuaries. It may not even be enough to keep Islamic State, also known as ISIS, from expanding. After 50 days of obvious failure, they go on, it's time to consider an approach that might work. Get American special forces on the ground with the Sunni Arabs themselves. The only other alternative, they say, is to resign ourselves to living with an al-Qaeda state and army, end quote. The Kagans give us another alternative, actually. It's endless war. When it comes to looking beyond the headlines and the immediate details that one finds in most reporting from the Middle East, I go to Robert Fisk, the dean and the wisest of the region's correspondents, who has been based in Beirut since the mid-1970s. Writing in Monday's Independent of London on the plan conceived in Washington to destroy the Islamic State, he asked, "Is there a plan B in Barack Obama's brain, or in David Cameron's, for that matter? I mean, we're vaguely told that airstrikes against the ferocious Islamic State may go on for a long time. But how long is long? Are we just going to go on killing Arabs and bombing and bombing and bombing until we go on bombing?" After the latest Islamic State beheading, Fisk writes, that of Britain Alan Henning, the gorge rises the thought of even discussing such things. But distance sometimes creates distorting mirrors, none more so than when it involves a distance between the Middle East and Washington, London, Paris, and I suppose Canberra. In Beirut, he comments, "I've been surveying the Arab television and press, and it's interesting to see the gulf that divides what the Arabs see and hear and what the West sees and hears. The gruesome detail is essential here to understand how Arabs have already grown used to jihadi barbarity. They have seen full video clips of the execution of Iraqis, and they have seen video clips of Syrian soldiers not only beheaded, but their heads then barbecued and carried through villages on sticks." Understandably, Fisk writes, Henning's murder didn't get much coverage in the Middle East, although television did show his murder video, which Western television did not, but it didn't make many front pages. In general, the Arab world was as uninterested in Henning's murder as we have been, for example, in the car bomb that killed 50 Syrian children in Homs last week. Had they been British children, of course, and the sentence trails off, we could finish it ourselves. Further down in the article, Fisk suggests that, quote, "perhaps we need to reframe our understanding of the Islamic State. British Muslims have said, quite rightly, that Muslims show mercy and the Islamic State is a perversion of Islam. I suspect and fear that they are wrong," Fisk writes. "Not because Islam is not merciful, but because the Islamic State has nothing at all to do with Islam. It's more of a cult of nihilism. Their fighters have been brutalized. Remember that they have endured, many of them, Saddam's cruelty, our sanctions, Western invasion and occupation, and airstrikes under Saddam and now airstrikes again. These people just don't believe in justice anymore. They have erased it from their minds. If we had not supported so many brutal men in the Middle East, would things have turned out differently?" Fisk inquires. "Probably," he answers his own question. "If we had supported justice, and I hesitate to suggest putting a certain man on trial for war crimes, would there have been a different reaction in the Middle East? In the Syrian war, they say that 200,000 have died. In Gaza, more than 2,000. But in Iraq," Fisk notes, "we suspect 500,000 died. And whose fault was that?" The Islamic State, he concludes, are the real or spiritual children of all of this. And now we face an exclusive form of nihilism, a cult as merciless as it is morbid. And we bomb, and we bomb, and we bomb. And then? Well, that's from Robert Fisk, the Dean of Middle East Correspondence, writing from his apartment in Beirut, where 9 years ago I interviewed him for Takes on the World. Given what has happened since, it seems like a lifetime. You can read Robert Fisk's entire article on counterpunch.org. For those wishing to demonstrate against the U.S. war in Syria and Iraq, each and every Monday, the South Coast People for Peace are gathering in front of the Wallala Post Office at noon, and I assume North Coast people there are welcome there as well. One piece of good news before I go to my guest is that 2 weeks ago, at the port of Oakland, there was another picket of a Zim ship, the Zim Shanghai, which was on its way to Russia, but it was going to stop in the port of Oakland, to unload its cargo and pick up more cargo and take it on its way. but for the second time, but this time it only took one day and about 70 pickets, not several thousand, and the cooperation of local 10 of the International Longshoremen Warehousemen's Union, ZIM was unable to get dock workers to unload their boats either in the early morning hours or the afternoon session, and consequently gave up and turned back and went to the port of Long Beach, which is quite a ways distance from Los Angeles, downtown Los Angeles, where they unloaded their cargo, and then, quite expensively, we expect, put the cargo on trucks headed to the Bay Area, but was unable to pick up any new cargo. This was reported in the local Bay Area Press on Channel 2 KDVU and the Jewish local newspaper, and widely reported in Israeli press, but not a word in the U.S. national media. This is a major development in the campaign for boycott, divestment, and sanctions in Israel, and the Israelis are rightfully concerned because other than marches and protests down Market Street or in front of Israeli consulates, this actually is hitting Israel where it hurts, and dock workers in this country, other sections of this country, and Canada and around the world seem to be following suit. There may be a situation in which ZIM ships have no place to dock.